Welcome back. This is Bob DeGree, and we're spending a moment in time with Mr. Andy Sacker.
Quite a few moments,
yes, I think, actually. You're right. And trying to catch up with the past. And I think that's we've gone through a whole lot with Andy's life, and now we're to a point of we've been talking about the Red Clover Bluegrass Band. Let's take it from there, Andy.
Okay. Well, that brings us into the somewhere around 1980-ish, I think. And the aforementioned Red Clover Band was formed by François Gaumont, who is now François Vollard. I explained that earlier. He formed that band, and it was good, but I don't know, probably wasn't enough work, and we had said that was the high point of the era of bluegrass fandom had slipped a bit, or maybe a lot.
So what the era? What was the dates on that? That you said it lasted for about a year, but what was that year? 79, 80.
Yes, it was one of those. It was in there, and I don't know exactly what it was.
Okay. And as it slipped, I know we're going to go into your next band, but as it slipped, was there a period of time where you didn't play bluegrass music for a while? That you just kind of tinkered around with your mandolin at home?
Probably. Yeah. Yeah, I think there was. And I'm fuzzy on dates in this far back.
Yeah.
And I could probably come up with some better dates if I went through some stuff that I have back at home.
Right. So
scrapbook.
So we're in the 80s.
Early 80s, and the next band that I joined was a new band called Gordon Stone and the Bluegrass Clones.
That was before Breakaway, for sure?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah. That was early 80s, 81 maybe, 80, 81. That was Gordon, the late Gordon Stone, superb banjo player. And Clyde Statz on bass, and Tim McKenzie on guitar. And I think it was just a quartet, the four of us.
Now, let me ask you, how did that come to being? I know that there's a part of me, and I'm sure a lot of other people, who want to know how these great ensembles kind of migrated together, or you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't know. I assume that Gordon decided that he wanted to have a bluegrass band, and so that's why it happened. It bore his name. The band bore his name, and so this was Tim McKenzie, who of course was with Pine Island, native Burlingtonian, and a wonderful guitarist and a great singer. He's got a voice to kill for. His voice is, I always thought, had kind of like a star quality voice.
I would agree.
Tim was, and Tim's still around, still plays well. He's got a lot of problems with his hearing now. And anyway, Clyde on bass, and I mentioned him. Mm-hmm. A couple of times I played with him back in Chicago in the late 60s, and then here we were again, and then we played at Hunt's, what was called the Opry, the Yankee Picking Opry. It was no longer that. It was bought by this guy named Yoram Sammets.
It was called R.W. Hunt Mill and Mining Company.
The R.W. Hunt, that's right, the full name, but yeah. mostly known as Hunt's, and that right at the corner of Pine and Main Street, the south east corner.
Was that the first time that you played in a band with Gordon?
No, he played with Dealer's Choice for a while. 4 or 5 months, maybe. Six months, maybe, the most. I guess that was the only time I played formally in a band with him. We might have played gigs together here or there.
I'm interested to know, when you talked about playing with people back in Chicago, those first days, you said, when I played with this particular person, or when I sang with this particular person, or when I heard this banjo, I just knew it was something really special.
Yeah.
When you first played with Gordon, did you feel...
Well, Gordon, yeah, I knew that he was pretty much a first-rate banjo player. He was really solid, strong, creative. He wrote a whole boatload of instrumental tunes. He didn't sing. Well, I think in Pine Island he did sing on one or two songs or something. He sang a little bit, but he didn't really sing in terms of bands. But he wrote instrumental things, and he wrote some very creative stuff. And we went on and played together until, well, I'll get into it, but I think the last time we officially played it together in a band, it was about the turn of the century. And we had been done a number of things together.
So the Clones were together for how long?
I'm not sure, Bob. Again, I'm going to say a year or two.
Because I certainly remember. What a catchy name, right?
Yeah. We had, and one of the first times we played in public, we played at Hunt's, and in the green room behind the stage, there were somebody had some masks that were kind of a cartoony kind of face, and it was just a cardboard mask with two rubber bands to hold. To go behind your ears, and we came out after a break, and we all had these on. And,
I loved that,
and it was Gordon Show and the Clones, and we were truly clones at that. Anyway,
that's a great. I love that story.
It was silly and funny. Anyway, and we recorded a demo, I guess, about six songs. Onto a one of those little portable Nakamichis, a smallish Nakamichi. Mm-hmm.
Our producer Tracy probably would know exactly what you're talking about.
I guess it was a cassette, like a thin
small cassette. Yeah,
small tape, not big. Mm-hmm. Tape. And but good, the sound was good. And
did it ever get produced? Meaning mass produced for consumption?
No, it was not. But I do have a copy of it, and I had it. It was on a cassette, and it's now on a CD. And it was good, and it was representative of what we were doing. It had a great version of one of the songs that I put together, which is from my all time favorite rock band, The Band, from their Brown album, which was 1968 or 1969. The song King Harvest Has Surely Come. And we did an excellent bluegrass-sized version of that song.
Awesome.
And offhand, that's all I remember. I remember my
contribution,
my glowing part of that album. And anyway, and I was pretty busy at that time. I was full time at the Burlington Bagel Bakery, and I worked. Which opened in 1979. One of the two owners was a guy I played who played in Dealer's Choice for a while. Roy Feldman played the fiddle, and so I worked for Roy and his partner Marty, and for about a year after it opened, I was the main baker, and later I became the manager for about.
I didn't know that. I did not know that you were a baker.
I was the manager of that business. It's a good money making business in Burlington. Bagels. Who would have thunk that? And so I was busy and in fact, the first couple of years I had like baker's hours, so I wasn't doing much band stuff or limited amount of band playing. Because I used to,
but it never left your heart, right?
I mean, wake up early.
You still were thinking about music, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And so the Gordon Stone and the Bluegrass Clones came and went, and around that same time, the very first breakaway began, and that was, as far as I know, the story is that a guy named David Mosher lived here, and I'm not sure if he lived in Burlington, but he lived somewhere, and he was... a native of, I think he was from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and maybe his wife was from Vermont or somewhere in New England. Anyway, they lived here, and he was and is, if he's still playing, if he's still alive, I don't even know. I assume he is. He good guitarist and mandolinist and very good singer, and he started a band with Gordon on banjo. So this is definitely after the demise of the Clones, with Gordon and with Peter Riley on bass, and who else was in it? He played guitar, and I don't know who played the mandolin. Or the fiddle,
Guskov?
It's possibly Guskov, because Guskov ended up being there not long after that. Anyway, that band was kaput because David Mosher left Vermont. They moved out west, or I think he ended up in the far northwest, like this Washington State, or maybe even British Columbia. Anyway, so Breakaway, the members who were still there, who were Gordon and Peter Riley and David Gusakov, hired me on mandolin and Tim McKenzie on guitar, and that was Breakaway. We kept that name, and this was about 85, and Breakaway was the band that you can see by going to Vermont PBS and looking up the guest of the house. It was a weekly show that ran for three seasons, and our show is it's a half hour show. It's a live performance, a live recording at the PBS studios in up at 40th and Allen there, and
we'll put a link to that on.
That's good. A lot of people have looked at that, and so that was good. We played out quite a bit, and locally.
So that incarnation of those five people, right? How long was that a staple for you guys? Because I've seen that recording. Mr. Riley shared that with me a long, long time ago. To me, that was you guys planting new bluegrass seeds that would germinate into something really special as time went on.
Well, yeah, I guess looking at the big picture of it, it was. Because Peter and I and Gordon went on to form the next, actually the third iteration of Breakaway. And that
so how long did the second iteration?
I think about 2 years, maybe. And
what was the, I don't want to use the word demise because that sounds really negative. What was the reason that Guzikoff and Tim McKenzie, David Guzikoff is who I'm referring to, an incredible violinist and fiddle player, and Tim McKenzie, what made them sidestep so that you would create the third incarnation?
Well, it was just, I don't know. It didn't go directly from the one band to the Breakaway second iteration to the third, because there were a couple of years. And again, well, it was 1988. It was late summer of '88. John Govan, who was the owner of Sneakers in Winooski, they had been having for a long time a Tuesday night jazz night, and they got a really great crowd, and they had great players, you know, Grippo and Asbel and Clyde on bass, and just a lot of good jazz players, and he decided that he would see if a bluegrass night worked out. So he asked Peter if he had a band, and Peter said no, but I'll form one for this for every Wednesday night at Sneakers. So we sort of reformed Breakaway again with Gordon on banjo and Peter on bass and myself and now we got Andy Green on guitar. Andy is about a generation younger than me. He's about 20 years younger than me, I think. So it was a multi-generational group. And a wonderful, solid guitarist and a good singer, too, good harmony singer and songwriter, Andy Green. So that was Breakaway, the third iteration, and that was the Breakaway that lasted almost a dozen years.
I think you're missing somebody there. Yeah, you forgot.
Well, initially it was just the four of us.
Okay.
It was Sneakers every Wednesday night, but it was a new night for music there, so it started off a little slowly. We played a couple of gigs with Dan Mahoney on dobro, and that's Danny's great, but he and Peter are both tenor singers, so wasn't quite a perfect fit, I guess. And and who else? I think maybe Roy played a night with us there, perhaps. And then Gene White stepped in, and Gene, I had mentioned way back, and he was in the original Dealer's Choice with me and Nancy Bevan, et cetera. Gene wanted to join, and we liked his. Like his plan.
Now, if I remember right, for the audience, I'm sure you guys remember hearing this, Gene played bass. That was what we remember Gene playing back in the day. At this time, he was quite an incredible fiddle player that played with you guys. I mean, I was at Bluegrass Night every Wednesday night it could be back then.
Yeah. Yeah, Gene had always played fiddle, I think, from childhood. I'm not sure exactly when he started, but I think he studied. Maybe I'm wrong with that. Anyway, he had been playing fiddle/violin for a long time. But he played electric bass. He also played guitar. He was a good guitarist too. And but he played bass. Yeah, when I first met him, he was playing bass with Coco in the Lonesome Road Band. He was there. He had a Fender bass, and I guess I must have mentioned that.
Yep.
Back in Central Vermont, and so Gene joined the band, and we slowly built that Bluegrass Night up to be really great, and I mean lots of folks who with a wide range of ages would come in and enjoy the music. I guess the best thing about Breakaway, well, one of the great things about Breakaway was the harmony singing. We had trios. I'm generally comfortable in the baritone slot, and when I'm not singing lead on a song, if I'm singing lead, then Andy Green would sing the baritone, and Peter was always on the tenor, singing with those guys was just so nice and so easy because they were both very competent and knew where their roles knew their parts.
Right.
And the baritone. I still like singing baritone. It's a nice part, and I like what the baritone does. Anyway, so that was great, and instrumentally it was good.
And then you guys recorded a tape.
We made a recording that Andy Green got some money somewhere, maybe some small inheritance or whatever, and he had some money, and he said, let's make an album. And this was maybe just a year after we started there at Sneakers, so it was 89 or 90, for sure it was done by 1990. And we recorded it at Harpo's, Dan Harpo Archer, who had a studio in 40th and Allen for a number of years. And we recorded it there, and we kind of just produced it by ourselves. And
what was the name of that?
The name of that was a name for one of Gordon's instrumentals that was on the album called Happy Landings.
And the photograph on the front of it was taken in front of Sneakers, if I remember right.
We were in front of Sneakers, yeah. Out on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Yep, we were. Yeah.
Now, at some point, and I know I'm probably getting a little ahead, and we can come back, but at some point... did you all sit at practice one day and go, man, this is really cool. This is really something.
Yeah, well, we did. We did. We did reach a point where somebody said maybe it was Riley. This is pretty good. We could maybe. This was after a few years there, I would guess. Although I don't remember the year exactly, but there was a bluegrass band contest in Cambridge or Boston. I don't remember.
You won the one at Winterhawk. I remember that.
That was the first time we went to do something. Special was we went down to this bluegrass band contest, and the judges were one of the judges was Irwin. I can't think of his first name now. Jet, the guy who started Rounder, one of the owners records. Rounder Records, and it was a big room with probably 100 people in it, and there were, I think, there were maybe six bands that played.
Was that an invitation only? Or did you have to?
I don't remember that.
Okay.
I was not involved with that side of it. I'm not sure how that worked, but I assume we must have had to enter it somehow with something. Maybe we sent somebody our cassette tape, Happy Landings. And the idea that I got was that we should have won first place, but we didn't. The ones who did was a band from Maine, and I don't remember any of the guys' names from that band or the name of the band, but they were good. They were a good band.
And so what's the story about you should have won? I want to hear.
Well, this. I thought from the reaction of the audience, we were the winners. I thought. And I think they really liked us. Irwin, the guy from Rounder, I think we were maybe a little too progressive for his taste or something like that. He said once that we were not exactly his cup of tea.
Oh my!
Yeah, that was later, and he judged us again. Couple times that I'll come to, and anyway, but that was fun, and we decided that we thought we were good enough to try to take it up to the next level and try to get going to do some touring and try to get booked into some festivals and stuff like that. And we went at some point and played, got invited to be a showcase band at the IBMA, the IBMA International Bluegrass Music Association. The first time we went, it was still held in
Owensboro, Kentucky.
Owensboro. The original, or that was where the festival was originally, at some hotel there. Second time we went, it had been moved to Louisville to a larger, to a great big hotel. It was quite an event. Anyway, we played a showcase, and I guess that went okay. But it wasn't.
What are those showcases? It's basically you're playing the showcase to be discovered.
Yeah, it's for a band to get people to listen, people who are interested in your music, in the music, bluegrass, and interested in finding bands that are. They want to listen to. Mm. We were always kind of, in some way, we were swimming against the tide with the IBMA because it may be different now, but in those days, I think there were still a lot of people who were very conservative in their bluegrass taste, and I know there were festival promoters, a couple of them that. Wouldn't even hire us because we had an electric bass player in our band, and they didn't like that. You can't do that.
It's not bluegrass.
Bill Monroe did not play with an electric bass. Many other fine first generation, not many, but a few of first generation bluegrass bands did, like the Osborne Brothers.
Osborne Brothers were very Jim progressive, though. They were pretty progressive.
Somewhat progressive, but they were also. Pretty traditional.
Yeah.
I mean, the first thing you've got to be in a bluegrass band, or in those days, you had to be, it's good to be Southern. That's not true. I shouldn't even say that.
So during that period of time, there was another up and coming, two young guys from New York,
Gibson Brothers.
Yeah, they were just starting out.
Yeah, I think they might have. I know we played a couple times with them before they got, before they were big. They played at the
Rattlin' Brook.
Rattlin' Brook 1 year, and I know that they, I think that was their first time I had seen or met them or heard them. And and they were kind of out of the mainstream too in terms of their sound. I mean, they had there was a certain Yankee-ness in there. I mean, they're from upstate New York. They're just across the lake there, so they're close by. And then they had kind of a little bit of a northern-ish accent in their playing.
I think the brother harmonies really helped them, propel them,
no,
for
they're,
sure.
They're first rate, mm-hmm. And
so
great songs, great playing.
So I remember, scratching my history of Breakaway. Didn't you have a tour or at least a few shows out in Arizona at one point in time?
We went to Arizona about a year, maybe a little over a year after we started, I think. Maybe 89. A fan, I think she was made, especially a fan of Peter Riley. She got us. Her father was a big shot in this company that had an annual meeting in Tucson in February, and she got us a gig there and flew us out there and everything. It was really
wow.
Really, kind of a star trip. It's the only one I've ever been on, but it was fun. It was fun, and it was great to be in the Southwest and to get away from Vermont that time of year, February.
Now, while you were out there, did you pick up any side gigs?
We did. I knew a guy. Who knew a guy who lived in Tucson, and he thought that he had something to do with bluegrass music, and he did indeed. Anyway, he gave me his phone number, and I called him the night we got there, or the day we got there. I think it was a Friday, and I told him who we were, and I asked him if they, you know, there were any opportunities that we might have to play in front of people. And he said, well, we've got a show tonight. And he let us do an opening act. I don't know if we got paid for it, but we were happy to, they might have given us something, a beer or two. And the band that who was doing the show was called Weary Hearts, and this was none other than Chris Jones.
Oh, no kidding.
And the banjo player became Alison Krauss's banjo player.
You mean Alison Brown?
No. After Alison Brown.
Oh,
He played with her for years.
Still plays with
them.
Block. Rory Block. Ron Block.
Ron Block. Yeah. He was the banjo player. And the mandolin player was my memory for names is so shitty now. He passed away. He had like an Italian name. Or something. Anyway, I can't think of it. Anyway, and we knew Chris Jones, or I knew Chris Jones because he went to school in Burlington. He went to UVM.
I didn't know that.
And when I first came to Vermont, somebody got me to do a workshop at the Living and Learning Center, UVM, for the Bluegrass Suite. They had two or three or four rooms of a bunch of bluegrass fans, and he was there. Paul Gittleson was there. Paul Gittleson also did a WRUV radio show. Pick and Paul, I used to call him Pick and Paul. And anyway, so Chris Jones, of course, now is you know, world known touring bluegrass. He's got a band called Chris Jones and the Night Drivers, and they played in Burlington a few just before the COVID lockdown, I think. And anyway, so we played with them, and then we also sat in another set at some bar in Tucson, and that was a group that had one of the McLaughlin brothers, not David McLaughlin. With names, I suck. I really suck. At least I can remember the names of the band people in the bands right. that I played in.
Right.
But anyway, we had a great time out there. We went, you know, we had like, I don't know, we were there for 4 or 5 days and did one gig for this business mm-hmm. meeting that was a stupid gig, but otherwise we had a good time.
Great.
And they had drive-through liquor stores down there in Tucson. I thought that was pretty funny. And we had a funny night in the motel room there. I think ended up with somebody breaking a bed.
Oh.
I think.
Rock stars, you know.
Not exactly. and I know that I drank enough so that I basically went to sleep early. Anyway, we did that thing. Anyway, we did a couple more. We did two more band contests, and they were both at the Grey Fox. And the first time we went down was I think 94 or so maybe.
I was there.
And again, Ken Irwin, I think. Ken is his first name, I think. Kenneth Irwin. Kenneth Irwin, again, was a judge there. I knew that didn't bode well for us. But anyway, we got second place in that band contest.
And I thought you got rooked.
And the band that won it was a band called Blue Mule, and they were a Canadian band, and they were good. But they were a band of ringers. They didn't regularly play together. They were kind of a put-together band. I think those guys from Canada, that's what they have to do. And anyway, and then we went, I think we didn't go the next year, but the year after that we went, and we won the Grey Fox band contest.
I'm not sure. This is probably a little on the dark side. I'm not sure which of those 2 years. But I remember you and I and my brother Mike hanging out a little bit. And since it's legal here in Vermont, we can talk about this. I rarely smoke pot, and I think you rarely smoke pot. But I think it was a joyous moment for you because you guys had just won. And
yeah, we won.
So
that was the year we won the contest.
Mike passed around a pipe, and you had a little bit, and I had a little bit, and he had a little bit, and then you and I were headed up to the hill to play some music. And all I remember is I didn't know how to play the guitar at all, and I did. I just, by the time I got up to the top of the hill, I had been so...
You were too stoned.
I was too stoned to actually remember how to strum my guitar. And I think you had said something like, "Boy, Bob, I am stoned." Because you hadn't smoked in a long time, I think. If memory serves me right, you said, "I really haven't smoked in an awful long time."
That's probably the case.
But as a trooper as you are, it took you probably maybe about 3 minutes, and you were right in your. I never was able to play the guitar that night, but I really did enjoy listening to you play.
I know there have been times where you're so wasted that you have to kind of relearn the process of playing. Let's see. Pick, strings, fingers, both hands. They got to do something.
They got to work together.
To get it going. Yeah. Anyway.
Those were great times, and you guys were really at the top of your game. And it was probably the couple of years before that I was blessed with having you guys ask me to come up and play a song or two each Wednesday night with you guys, and usually when Andy Green was in the bathroom during the sets. Poor fellow.
I remember that contest, the one that we won. We wanted to kind of look like a band too, so we decided that we had kind of a dress code, and we decided that not a strict code, but general guidelines, a solid colored shirt of some kind. Okay, and then pants like khaki or chinos or Dockers, whatever. But I don't know what. And also in that band contest, there was a band from Ithaca, and I don't remember their name. And they had a woman who played fiddle. I don't remember names at all, and she. She told us afterwards, she said that we looked like, she called us J. Crew Grass. Because we had a look.
You really look stylish. You almost looked like, if I remember right, almost like the evolution of Miami Vice playing bluegrass. Well, you guys were really stylish.
Well, Gordon could have, I could see him wearing an orange sport jacket, like the Miami Vice thing. Anyway, yeah. That was just a...
So about... Okay, just that's going to... Breakaway was a band for a number of years. When you won that contest, were you about halfway through the years, or... Not that it matters, but just kind of...
I think it was.
Timeline.
Maybe... Yeah, roughly... Roughly that, and I don't remember if.
And what did you win when you won that contest?
Well, we got hired back to play like two sets in the next summer's Grey Fox Festival. Two shows in the hot part of the afternoon. Not great slots by any means. But it's just kind of prestige because it was certainly the biggest, best-known festival in the Northeast.
Correct.
It's maybe not like winning the band contest at, I don't know where, Merle Fest. But it was a pretty big deal. And the band, I should also mention, I think that might have been, I don't know if that was, I think, after... The first time we asked Gordon to leave the band, and anybody who knows Gordon knows that he had a problem with substances, and most unfortunate guy with terrific talent, and at one point he got. Heavily into doing some kind of substances, and he got to a point where he would nod off while we were standing on the stage, and we'd have to give him nudge with an elbow to wake him up. And it got so that was happening a lot, and we asked him to leave the band. And we hired Danny Cohen to sit in.
What was that reaction? Was he understanding of the situation, or was that a...
I think that we maybe Gene and Peter and I got together with his Gordon had a cousin who was living in Montpelier, I think. I forget his. Chip, I think his name was Chip Stone. And he, we tried to just intervene and try to get Gordon to do something to try to turn himself around. And I don't remember exactly how long he was out of the band, but it was at least 6 months or maybe a year. I'm not sure. Danny Cohen would probably know. I hope you talk to Danny Cohen.
Yeah, Danny's on the list. That must have been tough for you guys, because tough and good. I'm going to guess it was a struggle thinking about going forward with somebody who had those challenges. And as a friend, you, I'm sure, wanted him to get healthy. So that's really kind of a, you know, you want your friend there because he's such a good guy and a good musician. But for the health of the band and the other part, you can't.
Yeah.
That had to be a really tough decision for you guys.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it was. It got to the point where it had to be done, so that's what we did. And Danny Cohen is such a delightful person and great singer and lively personality and great on any stage, and a good solid bluegrass banjo picker too. He's not Gordon Stone, but he's fabulous. And Gordon came back, and at some point, I'm trying to think of the years now, and I'm not sure.
Well, why don't we just take a break here, and we'll come back. Chasing the Past with Mr. Andy Sacker.